As I was coming up in the car today, every hour I would turn on the radio to see if we were at war yet. The Israeli cabinet is meeting, well, they were meeting live in terms of the broadcast on the radio. They were meeting as I was driving up and trying to determine what their response to the circumstances there in Israel would be. Over the last few days, I've picked up a few dispatches off the internet, and in leading into my sermon today, I'd like to read you some of these and lay out a little bit about what's taking place. Now, I pulled an article by Ariel Sharon. Anybody know who he is? Well, he's the one that walked up on the Temple Mount and upset the Palestinians so much. And so he published an article which came out of Wall Street Journal editorials. And I want to read you just a comment that he makes to introduce this. He says, "I went to visit the Temple Mount with members of the Likud faction in the Knesset, as I have done in the past, first of all to inspect and ascertain that freedom of worship and free access to the Temple Mount is granted to everyone, Christians, Muslims, and Jews in particular, since for 3,000 years it has been the site of our most sacred shrine. The exercise of this right has been undermined for some time now by threats and violence from the Palestinian Authority in order to pressure Israel to make more concessions in Jerusalem and the Temple Mount than it has already offered. Make no mistake, the circumstances in Israel today have to do with control of the Temple Mount and access to Jerusalem and the possible formation of a Palestinian state. That's what all the issues relate to and focus on. Ever since the reunification of Jerusalem in 1967, Israel has made solid arrangements on the Temple Mount to ensure that freedom of worship and free access to the site was rendered to all. Prior to Israeli rule, the right was denied to Jews. Neither I nor any Israeli citizen, Arab or Jew, needs to seek permission from the Palestinian Authority or from any foreign entity to visit the Temple Mount or any other site in the sovereign territory of the State of Israel." That's the position that came out and where this thing blew up into the circumstances where it is today. Pulled an article from the Jerusalem Post. This was October the 3rd. It says, "The Palestinians are calling for international intervention to stop the violence in the West Bank and Gaza. They are demanding that the UN Security Council send international forces to the Temple Mount to keep Israeli soldiers away from the site." The Palestinians are demanding, calling for international protection and control of the Temple Mount. Now, that's interesting. I would have never imagined that that would ever happen prophetically. Another article that came out on the 3rd of October is one I had not heard of before in terms of the request being made. 7 years after the Oslo Accords, this is from The Independent, a newspaper in England. 7 years after the Oslo Accords, the already dying peace negotiations appear to be over. In a measure of the Palestinian lack of trust in the Americans as mediators, one of Mr. Arafat's most senior negotiators earlier appealed to Europe for help. He said talks could not now continue unless the European Union provided international protection, including troops and observers for Palestinians facing Israeli forces. They've also made a direct appeal to the European Union to send troops and observers and intermediaries to protect the Palestinians and to secure the Temple Mount. From the Spokesman Review on the 7th, Saturday, I want to read to you a little bit of some of the rhetoric to incite. You know, the call over there by some is for war, and the call over there by some is for peace. Right now, the call for war is being yelled very loudly and very vocally. The article in the Spokesman Review said, "Young Palestinians incited by fiery words." These days, the talk in Gaza is not about the future of the peace process. Rather, the talk is about the future of the Palestinian uprising, and the talk is bloody indeed. "The spirits of all the martyrs are roaming over our heads and telling us not to stop," declared the radio announcer who read a statement from the youth movement of Yasser Arafat's Fatah organization Friday afternoon. "Be united. Shout with rage until we reach freedom. Let the battle continue until we defeat the military occupation." And at Friday prayers at Al-Salam Mosque, the sermon was anything but peaceful. The smell of the blood of our martyrs is like a holy perfume, the preacher intoned, his voice booming from the loudspeakers over a sleepy Gaza neighborhood. Finally, the last article, again from the Independent, on October the 9th. Now, that would be today, but it was from Jerusalem and was posted in Jerusalem last night. So it's their time on the 9th. The entire Middle East is bracing itself for the expiration tonight of an Israeli-imposed peace ultimatum amid fears that the region could be engulfed in war if Yasser Arafat fails to end the wave of violence in which scores have died. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak warned the Palestinian leader yesterday that peace negotiations would be at an end if the bloodshed continued beyond tonight, and that he would instruct his forces to act accordingly. I read the paper this morning and it said ceasefire, and I listened to the news this afternoon and it says there were gun battles running up and down many of the lines there. And if the Palestinians prefer not to choose peace, we know how to respond, Mr. Barak said, shortly before beginning the 25-hour fast that marks Yom Kippur. The Jews keep an extra hour to be safe because they don't want to make a mistake and miss the day. It says the most sacred day of the Jewish year. There are signs, however, that ending the Palestinian uprising is beyond Mr. Arafat's control and that other Palestinians are striving to seize the initiative on the streets of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Why must man have the option of war? Why must man have that kind of an option? The answer to that question lies very closely related to the meaning of this day, to the Day of Atonement. We get up every morning, we begin to do something. Every night before we go to bed, the last thing we do is the same. We walk into the door here as we come into services. We do that and we sit down and we do it at this moment as well. It's simple as making choices. We are constantly making choices. Right now, everyone here is choosing whether to listen or to think about something else. We're choosing whether to listen and focus on what is taking place here or on maybe what we're going to eat tonight or what we ate last night, right? Our minds are full of distractions. There's a lot of competition for our thoughts, and we are constantly deciding what our focus is going to be. It's a choice. It's a decision that we actually make. I'm a shopper. I feel like confession time. I'm a shopper. My name is Mark. Michelle is not. And we process things somehow differently in that way. And, you know, this is unusual because usually the women are shoppers and the men are not. And so some years ago, Michelle wanted a dress, and it's the last one we bought her. No. But we sat down and kind of planned out a budget in terms of what we would set aside. And so we set aside $5. But we went out to buy this dress. And we walked into a shop, and we went down the racks and looked, and within the budget we had set aside, and she found one she liked, and she says, "I like this one." I said, "Well, honey, you haven't shopped around." I said, "You don't know. They might have a prettier one or a cheaper one. There might be one on sale. There might be I don't mean I'm a tightwad. I mean a better price for the value, right? There might be something nicer that you haven't seen." I said, "There's other dress shops. We need to check some of the shops." And she says, "But I like this one." I said, "Oh, come on." So she went with me, and we went to a number of other shops and looked, and she tried dresses, and we checked prices, and we did all kinds of things. And when we got done with all the places, she said, "Well, you know, I still like that one." And we went back to the first store. She bought the dress, and probably that year, I suppose, it was to take to the feast. I don't exactly remember that end of it. But she had found what she wanted and bought it and was off. Now, me, I wanted to check out all my options before I made a choice. I bought a pair of boots 2 years ago. And this was a personal trial to me. I bought a pair of boots. And I needed a special pair of boots because I needed something I could use for mountaineering. But I wanted boots I could also walk around and hike in as well. And I needed to have certain things they would do. I had to put a pair of crampons on these boots. And yet I wanted a pair that wouldn't break my foot. So I began to study boots. I couldn't afford to buy a bunch of pairs of boots, and they're very expensive. And I'd buy one pair, and after I bought it, I'd be so tight that I'd never buy another pair. And I'd use this one pair, and they had to work. So I studied how the last is built in a boot, and where the, in a mountaineering boot, they have a little stiffener, and whether that was pushed forward to the toes, which stiffens the toe, or whether it's back to let your toe flex. And, you know, I'm studying the crampons and how to fit this on. And I, with all that study, went to a couple different stores around town, and I went out finally, and I bought the pair of boots. And I took them home in a box, and I put them in my office, and they sat there for 3 months. And once in a while, I'd take them out of the box, and I'd look at them, you know, and think about it. I put them back in the box, and they sat there. Well, after 3 months, I took them back to the store and turned them in because I just wasn't sure. I waited another year. And I went out, started asking some more questions on boots, and I studied a little more. And finally, I went back and bought a little different pair, just slightly different pair, a little bit stiffer that I had studied and decided this is the one, brought them, put them in the box, took them home, in my office, set them on the chair. And I looked at them and I says, you know, I'm going to have to use these boots or I'll be analyzing this for the rest of my life. And finally, I just put them on and went out and hiked in them and I says, okay, that's it. It's over. I bought them. I can't take them back. Now, we all make choices in different ways. But we all choose our various things. We choose how to spend our time. We choose who our friends will be. We choose what it is that we're going to dedicate ourselves to. God gives us the power of choice. And choice is an incredibly powerful thing. In so doing, we can choose good or evil. We can choose blessing or cursing. I mean, these things don't just descend on us. We choose. We can choose wisdom or foolishness, expediency or sacrifice, what comes easy or what we're willing to sacrifice and work hard towards or contribute. We make all those choices. Right now, someone on a loudspeaker in the Palestinian areas of Israel is proclaiming for the youth to get up and choose war. You know what it's like to be incited to war? I know what it's like. I volunteered for the army. I didn't get drafted. And I stayed in the infantry even when they offered me schools because I had to be where I could fight. And I went to Vietnam, but my unit went to Germany because I didn't want to go to Germany. I didn't want to polish my shoes and stand in parade formation. I wanted to be in the jungle and I wanted to fight. And we used to sing the songs and we used to do the things that you do to mentally prepare for that. And in that sense, I was incited for war. It was something I wanted to do. When you take a young teenager and put a rock in his hand and he runs up and charges somebody that's got a rifle that's firing, that's not a logical, rational thing to do, but it is a choice. It's a choice just the same. The power of choice is incredibly, incredibly powerful. More sometimes than we really give it credit for what it is. I gave a sermon previously where I kind of boiled down in my mind at least what I thought, how this life works and what the rules are. And I mentioned it. It was actually in preparation for this sermon, and I used it earlier. But I described it this way. This is what life's all about. Everyone gets to choose. Those who choose God live forever. Those who do not will cease to exist. That's what life's all about. Choosing or not choosing to put God first. And until we have chosen God fully, we have not really chosen at all. And I mean to express to you today what it means to choose God fully. You can choose something like that pair of boots I had and bring it home, but not quite indeed be satisfied because all of the options had not been exercised. You can't do that with God. You can't afford to turn back on God. Now, this is where we maybe get more directly into some of the symbolism for atonement. Revelation 20. There's a passage here that is interesting. And there's a word in this passage that I feel fairly confident that a number of us here have never really focused on. In fact, when I addressed the sermon, when this came to my mind and I began to look at it, there was a word here that I had not focused on. And as I spoke down in Lewiston today, Joe Hasner came up and said, well, you know, that's interesting. I've read that 1,000 times. Revelation 20, verse number 1. I saw an angel come down from heaven, having a key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, laid hold on the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So Satan is loosed now, and he has opportunity to impact and affect us. He's bound for 1,000 years of the millennium. Cast him into the bottomless pit, shut him up, set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more until 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. He must be. Have you ever thought of that? It doesn't say that Satan is going to be or will be or can be. It says he must be. It is necessary to release Satan for a little time after the millennium is over. Necessary. Important to God's plan. Well, that's remarkable. God has his kingdom set up on the earth, his peace as far as the eye can see. Everything's working. God's in charge. People are obedient. And God says Satan now must be released. I think that's just an incredible thing to think about. We generally focus on atonement, on why Satan must be put away. We're going to be at one with God. Get rid of Satan. We can be at one with God. I want to focus today on the flip side of that, why Satan must be around. There are times when Satan is allowed and given permission, authority by God, to be around. And that fulfills part of God's purpose as well. You cannot truly choose good unless you fully reject evil as well. You can't just choose good. You have to also reject evil. It takes both. Choosing good on its own basis only is not enough. And not just some evil, for you and me especially. Not just some evil. Evil in all its glory. Now, I don't mean you have to be out there and participating to get a good taste. We get a good taste. I'm just saying, not just any old evil. Evil in all its glory has to be rejected to truly and fully choose God and good in his way. Evil with all of its attraction that is there. Notice Matthew 4. Scripture here where Christ, after having grown up as a child, teenager, now a young adult, medium-sized adult maybe, what we call middle age is like 65, so I'm not sure what this would be, so Matthew 4, he was baptized by John, and now he's being taken out to be tempted by Satan. So just prior to proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom of God in a public ministry and going out to represent God the Father in that way, he faces Satan first and does battle on that basis before he goes on. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. And when the tempter came to him, he said, if you're the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. And he answered and said, it's written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds in the mouth of God. So here he is physically weakened and desiring physical nourishment, and Satan tempts him to not finish this process that was going to take place and to just satisfy himself now. Surely he had hungered enough. And Christ basically said, look, that is not my focus. Now, this is a miraculous fast, obviously, 40 days and 40 nights. It's a miraculous fast. But he says, I am not here to satisfy this flesh alone. And then the devil took him up to the holy city and set him on a pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, now trying to strike at vanity, except that there was none, throw yourself down, it's written, he shall give his angels charge concerning you, and in their hands they'll bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. And Jesus said to him, it is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. So, first he tried to tempt him to satisfy this flesh. Then he tried to tempt him to satisfy the mind, the vanity, the desire to be recognized or accepted. Didn't work. The devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. So now Satan goes for the knockout punch. You know, when boxers are fighting and they're punching back and forth, and one of them's waiting for the other one to kind of drop his guard or drop his punch or his hands a bit so that he can take him out. And this is Satan now trying to take out Christ, tried to trip him up on a couple of things, saves the best for last, and here's the blow. Satan's best shot is coming. He said, showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, and he said, all these things I will give you, had to have them to give them, if you will fall down and worship me. And Jesus said, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Satan said, I will give you all of this power, all of this glory and control, all of this earth you can administer if you will worship me. It was the best that he had to offer. It was all in that sense that he had. Satan took his best shot, offered Christ this world. And you remember what Christ told the disciples just before he died? He said, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. Satan offered him something that he turned down and put God first, and he said, I have overcome the world. All of these temptations and desires and the poles and anything that would compete with God, I have set aside. That's what Satan was offering Christ, is this world. Satan offered him the best that he had, and that's what he offers us, the best that he has. And you know, sometimes it looks pretty good. Satan wants to offer us sin in a way not just that is kind of enticing, but that is incredibly enticing. He is allowed to do that. He is allowed to take his best shot, and unless we reject sin in that way, we do not fully choose to obey God or to put him first. You know, submitting to Satan or participating with him is kind of like speeding down a road very, very fast. At the end, though, is a hairpin turn. There's no way in the world to make the corner, but while you're speeding down the road, it's delicious. It's glorious. You know, the windows. I had a Camaro when I got out of the Army. 67 Camaro. I cannot believe I got rid of that car and it turned into a classic. I just, 4-speed and polycarbs, and just a beautiful car. And I used to roll all the windows down in the winter and turn the heat on so that I could sit inside and be warm and still look cool, you know. And, well, it was cool. I used to love it, you know. And I remember you'd take that and you could break the tires out. You could scratch in all three gears. I couldn't quite do it in fourth, but I remember, you know, that wasn't enough, so you'd get the thing in reverse and roll it backwards to get the brake better, and then you'd pop the clutch when you're going backwards about 10 miles an hour. And I mean, it looked like a dragster coming out the back. But I mean, it was, at that time, it was what the world had to offer. I thought it was the finest thing in the world. You know, what Satan offers us is like speeding down that road toward a hairpin curve, and you're not going to make the curve. It doesn't work. But boy, is it fun on the way. It might be sin, but it's actually desirable. It's something that we would want. Now, we stop wanting that to the degree that we start to see it from God's eyes. He's looking up a little higher. He says, I can see a little hairpin curve at the end of this. I don't think you want to go that fast. But, you know, Satan would give it to us from his view. That's why Satan must be released, to make his case, to give his best shot, so that those choosing indeed will choose fully and well. It's not enough. It's not enough to just obey God. You have to reject Satan and his ways as well. Satan was the first one to use his option of choice to rebel. Ezekiel 28 is a passage that addresses that. The first one. Ezekiel 28, verse 14. You are the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. I made you what you are. I gave you what you have. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of the fiery stones. When you see the ark and you have the cherubim over the top of the ark, the mercy seat, and the wings are stretched out, that's a portrayal of what we would understand Satan to have been. A cherub that actually covered the mercy seat on the throne of God in heaven. One of the covering cherubs. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created until iniquity was found in you. You were perfect until you sinned. And so there was a time when Satan exercised his right of choice to rebel. What's interesting, until Satan sinned, though, it appears that even the angels had not yet fully chosen. Because, you see, none of the angels had sinned. They had only chosen good. They had chosen to obey God, and they were all in obedience. When Satan sinned, now there were two choices. There was a choice they had never had before. I mean, it was there apparently, but it is an exercise of the mind that had never been made. Now they had a choice between obeying God and disobeying and being with Satan and rebelling with him. And a third of the angels turned and sinned as well. So their choice, when it expanded and gave them another option to consider, a third of the angels actually partook. They had not fully chosen until they had all the options presented. A third of the angels in that process rebelled. Tonight, after we're done eating, after we're done fasting, Derek was also sitting here drawing milkshakes and turkeys and on his drawing book. I made him stop. We were all looking at the drawings instead of listening to Perry. Tonight, after we're done fasting, some of us will go out for a bite to eat, maybe to a restaurant. And you sit down at the restaurant, and because in many cases we've saved our second tithe, which gives us a percentage and allows us to live in a manner that's higher than what we would normally live, you'll go into the restaurant of our choice. Some of us will be at home, but you can pretty much, you go where you can eat what you want there. You know, if it's places too expensive, we go somewhere else. And you open the menu up and you look around, well, what do I want to have? And you'll pick something that sounds really nice. And then after you get that served to you, there'll be service all around the table and the tables beside, and you look around and, you know, chances are you'll see, oh, I didn't know they had that. I didn't know they had paper salmon. No, here. I thought this stewed okra was the top of the line. And it's like if your children ask for, can I have a pop tonight? Sure, sure. Oh, they're excited. All right, so you sit down. There comes the 7-Up. And then the child on the next table comes and has a 7-Up with a cherry and some red juice on top, a little Shirley Temple. All of a sudden, this plain old yucky 7-Up just isn't what it used to be. You know, there's something better. Because you hadn't fully chosen. You didn't know what the options were. And so, that's just a very natural dynamic. Michelle and I were in Kalispell for Sabbath. And I spoke there in Kalispell. And a few of the members of that congregation didn't come up. And Rock Corbett had set up where we would go down and have church down at their place as well. And they're south of Missoula. And I was a little tired because I was in Kennewick and Lewiston and then Kalispell the last couple of days. And so we stopped on the way down, going to give me a cup of coffee. So we pull up at a gas station. I needed gas, too, because it had been a lot of miles getting up there and back and came in late. So I had to gas the car. And I go in for the coffee, and it was just a regular service station. And so I just poured it out, and they didn't even have the little creamers with flavors in them or anything. They just had the plain old yucky dry stuff. So I took about six of them, tried to make me a fake latte, you know. And I'm pouring this in and throwing all the wrappers out, stirring it up and tasted it and said, well, I'm glad to have a cup of coffee. You know, it's nice to have something to finish the trip. Well, I walked outside and we started to pull out, and right there in the corner of the parking lot was an espresso trailer. And I'm looking at this rotten old cup of coffee with powdered creamer in it. And I stopped the car. Rock's in the seat. Michelle and Nancy were in the other car. And Rock's in there. And I go, you know, and I stop the car, get out, pull the cup off, pour the coffee into the ditch, you know, wring it out, give it to the lady, says, I'll take an espresso. You know, I hadn't fully chosen. I didn't know all the options that would be there if I'd have just taken a chance. God gives Satan permission to entice us. We have his power. We have his guidance, God's guidance and power. But he actually gives Satan permission to give us all the options that are there. And until we reject what he gives us, we have not fully chosen God. That's just the way it works. God doesn't make us a part of his family until we've seen the options, because he doesn't ever want us to look back or go off and do something else. Now, it's interesting that even in growing up, our children have to do the same basic thing. They have to do the same basic thing. We can't raise our children in cocoons, although sometimes I think we wish we could. But we can't really raise them in cocoons, because the Bible is full of both success and failure. And our children need to recognize each one. Now, we don't let our children play in the street. The consequences are too high. There's no lesson to be learned. We don't let them play in the street. But until our children personally choose not to play in the street, they're not ready to be on their own. And so they need to have the option of the choices made to them before they can actually safely walk out the door. They need to have exercised those choices and exercised them well. Maturity is when you have the option to do good or to cause harm, and you choose to do good all by yourself. Now, some people never grow up. That's just the fact. Some people never grow up. They just get older, but they don't mature. Choice is what character is all about. Character has been defined as choosing right over wrong with knowledge. Having knowledge and information and making that right choice has sometimes been a definition of character. Fact is, without choices, there's no way to know if character even exists. You don't know if someone will rebel unless they have the choice to rebel, and unless they see that as an option, you don't know if they're going to rebel until they decide not to. You don't know that necessarily in advance. Choice is what character is all about. Psalm 15 describes character. Now, it's interesting because character, the word character is not even in the Bible. At least it's not in the King James. I haven't checked specifically if it's in the New King James. Psalm 15, though, in my New King James, has the subheading which describes what the psalm is about, and it says the character of those who may dwell with the Lord. Now, that's not scripture. That's just the description. So let me read Psalm 15 and show you what character would be. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who's going to dwell on your holy hill? Who is going to be with you at your side, doing your work, part of your family? Who's going to be there? Who's like that? He who walks uprightly, works righteousness, and speaks the truth in his heart. He who chooses to do right things is going to be with me. And, verse 3, he who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against a friend. And he who chooses not to do the wrong things, the one who's choosing to do right and the one who's choosing not to do the wrong, they are going to be with me in my temple. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change, a person who is not in it for the physical gain or the personal advantage, but in it to do what is right. He who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. And then it makes an interesting statement at the end here. He who does these things, chooses good, rejects evil, doesn't take personal advantage, isn't in life for satisfaction for the self, he who does these things will never be moved. You're solid. That's how you get to where you're locked in place. That's how you fully choose. You reject evil and you choose good. But you simply can't choose good on its own. you have to turn from the other also and walk away. What was it that Mr. Armstrong's mind got stuck on at the end of his life, so to speak? I mean, where did his focus absolutely become fixed before he died for quite a period of time? Everybody knows, the two trees. Everybody knows. Michelle and I were in Pasadena. I heard the two trees to the point where I could have given it myself. I could have written it. I could have counted the word. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not a lot. Because every time he spoke in Pasadena and he gave that sermon, which was a number of times, sometimes in a Bible study, sometimes in a service, we were there and I heard that sermon. And when the regional ministry or the ministry came in for the refresher, and he would come and talk to them, and in the latter part of his life, he wasn't always that strong, and I remember a time sitting behind him as he was speaking to the ministry there in one of the classroom areas, and he hadn't even shaved or something, but he was there, and he was there to speak, and he oftentimes spoke about the two trees. It's like his mind almost froze on that point for the last part of his life. What is the story of the two trees about? Now, if we all took a piece of paper and wrote down what we think the story is about, we would probably say something in relationship, obviously, to man having the right to choose. We would say it's a story of man's first sin. Adam and Eve, their first sin. But it's also the story of Satan's best shot, his best offer. It's also the story of the best that he had to give. It's the pearl of great price in reverse. It's the two trees. We always tend to look at it from the one side. Notice Genesis 3. And again, there's a word here that kind of pops out. And maybe we've focused on it. Maybe we haven't. Genesis 3:1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. The serpent was more cunning than anything else in the creation, more deceiving, more self-serving, and who do you think gets to go up against Adam and Eve? Oh, can't we just be up against the horse or the frog? Or the elephant? But why Satan? Who gave Satan permission to go in and do what he did? God did. Some of you would have watched the Olympics, and I watched when I could, and sometimes I was on the road at night, and fortunately it was on the TV channel that's on the radio, and so I'm listening on the radio, and I heard the girls' volleyball coming in from Montana, and I mean, my hands were sweating listening to that match. I said, well, surely they wouldn't have put it on here if we weren't going to win. You know, they'd throw it in the trash can or something. But I heard on the radio as well and could not get home the wrestling match for the Greco-Roman wrestling for the gold medal. Did anybody see that? Couple. It was awesome. Here is Godzilla from Russia. A man had never lost a wrestling match internationally in competition. He'd never lost. And he was so strong. I mean, he's taller than most men. He's stockier than most men. He's in great shape. He works out hauling logs around and stuff just to practice for conditioning. You could see his ribs. I mean, he was tight. And just a monster of a man. And large. And so he's the competitor for the gold medal against the man from the United States. Now, the man from the United States is no wimp, but you got to understand, it was David and Goliath going in there. This man had never lost. He was so strong that he made up his own moves that nobody else does. That he would turn around and reverse on someone, and we're not talking some little scrawny person like me. We're talking world-class wrestling champions that are in shape and fit and know the move. And he would turn and reverse on them, grab them backwards, and lift them off the ground upside down. Muscle them up in the air, them fighting, flailing, grabbing with all their muscle and weight, and he could literally just force them up off the ground, and then he would drop them on their head and pin them by putting their shoulder then down to the ground. And there's nothing they could do. You have no traction, no defense. So it was, the man was simply, totally in a class by himself. And who here's this man now that's going up against him, you know. And I was reading one of the articles, what were you doing before the match? Well, he was crying. Now, the United States man actually was crying. He was going to go in and fight Godzilla. You know, you got to understand, I mean, this what that was like. And the United States contestant, our man, went in there and fought the battle and actually won and took home the gold. But you know what he had to do to take home the gold? He had to fight the best contestant that there ever was in the history of the sport. The most recognized, the strongest, the most capable, the most renowned person in Greco-Roman wrestling that there ever was. Isn't that amazing? Who do we get to contend with in this life? Who did Adam and Eve have to face? You know, Eeyore? I don't think so. Oh, Adam and Eve, how you doing? You know, I mean, no, it wasn't like that. I mean, the most cunning of any of the creation was who God allowed to test them to see if they would keep their focus on God. You tell me that we don't have to reject evil to choose good? It's not just evil. It's evil in all its glory. The best that Satan has to offer. What's the most important possession that Satan has? What do you think it is that Satan desires the most? Riches, fame, beauty, desire, authority. I've heard politicians say sex is nothing, power. That's where the real benefit is. That's what is the ultimate opportunity, power. What do you think Satan desires the most? Any of those things, or would it be maybe the power to choose? The power to be able to reject God as his master. Not that you can, but the power to run and turn and go the other way. The power of choice, I bet, I believe, is the most valuable thing from his perspective that he has. And what is it that he would offer you and I as his best shot? That same power, God gives us the right, but to choose and turn away would be his best shot. Hebrews 10 describes what we call the unpardonable sin. Hebrews 10:26. If we sin willfully. Willfully doesn't mean that you had a bad day, you're weak, you're struggling, you didn't quite come through. Willfully here means that it is a conscious choice to sin and to go the other way after we have received the knowledge of the truth. Remember maturity, remember character, knowing the difference between good and evil and choosing good. This is the flip side. Knowing the difference between good and evil and choosing evil. Willfully, after we've received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversaries. I told you earlier this summer about the hitchhiker I picked up. Remember the Russian going to Mount Rainier? And you remember what one of his most fundamental questions was? Why is there so much suffering if God is love? And I said, because God gave man the right to choose. And God wants a relationship. Anybody here ever had a relationship with a computer? Or a VCR? Or a mechanical pencil? What do you mean a relationship? Inanimate objects can't relate. They can't make choices. They can't. So So I was asking Gleb, I said, well, when you marry someday, if you do, do you want to have someone who has to do everything you say, the way you say it, when you say it, and how you say it? Or do you want someone who relates to you? And he says, well, of course, relates to me. I said, well, God does too. And he gave man the right of choice. And only those who choose him will be in his family, in his kingdom one day. God could say, no murder, that's not good, I get rid of murder. And man could say, fine, then I'll hate them as well. And God could say, no hatred, we'll get rid of hatred, that's bad. And man could say, fine, then I'll just be angry. And God could say, well, you can't be angry because that's not good either. And man could say, well, then I'll be frustrated. And God would have to go from there and control every single thought. And so instead, he gives man the power to choose. And then the choice must be made. That's what life's all about, making choices, putting God first. Satan's presence actually allows us to make that choice in the fullest possible way. It actually allows us to more fully choose. Now think about that. When we marry, we do not just choose our mate. I want to marry you, fine, I'll marry you, fine, we've chosen our mate. That's not enough. For that marriage to be sustained, a man and woman have to choose fully, which means they have to also reject the advances of any other suitor who comes along. Because it's not a choice you reconsider or make again. So to choose fully, even a husband and wife, not only choose each other, but they reject the advances of any other suitor who comes along. And that's what so much of what is wrong in our society today is those choices are not fully made. Luke 9. No one, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. James 1. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. We cannot have two opinions on whether or not to put God first. Satan has permission to offer us the best that he can, and that's why he's loose now. And I believe that's why he will also be loosed at the end of the millennium again. So mankind can fully choose. So mankind can choose fully to put God first, and also so that no other choosing will ever again take place.